Welcome to Alzheimer's Speaks Radio. I'm your host, Lori LeBay, and I'm so excited that you're joining us today. We are going to have a fascinating conversation, as usual, as we learn from people all around the world at all ages and stages of life. Stay tuned as we shift our dementia care from crisis to comfort.
Here we go. What you think about?
Well, hi, everyone, and welcome to Alzheimer's Speaks. I'm thrilled you can join us today. We're going to have a really interesting conversation today about doing dementia differently. We're going to be talking with Zach Parlier, who is the administrator at English Rose, and how they use a non-traditional approach to memory care. Now, before I introduce you to Zach, I always like to do a couple of shout outs. So one, I want to do a shout out to Lorenzo's Youth Summit that is coming up on June 15th and 14th, and you can register today. It is free. Just go to lorenzoshouse.org. This is a fantastic opportunity for our children to come together who are dealing with dementia. And ages are from young until, I want to say, they're 30. So check out lorenzoshouse.org to register for the Youth Summit coming up, again, June 14th and 15th. Also want to give a big shout out to Twiddles and the Adaptive Wrap. And Twiddles, if you don't know, if you're not familiar with them, they are meeting the sensory needs of those living with dementia by providing comfort, warmth, and activity. They have a great variety of products that you can choose from. Just go to the number 4twiddles.com, 4twiddles.com. And of course, we encourage you to go to alzheimerspeaks.com, check out our free educational resources, as well as our book, Betty the Bald Chicken. And of course, I would also encourage you to check out Dementia Map, our global resource directory, which is free to access. And if you have a service or product or tool, we would love to talk to you about becoming one of our member profiles. We have both free and paid profiles, so don't let budget limit you. Reach out to me at radio@alzheimerspeaks.com. So, Zach, I'm so excited to have you back with us. A lot has happened since we talked last. I'm going to have you introduce yourself to our audience, because not everybody probably heard that last show that we did. and tell them a little bit about yourself and your role at English Rose.
Certainly. And thank you so much for having me on again, Lori. We had a blast last time, and I'm excited to be on for a second time as a recurring guest, hopefully. My name is Zach Parlier. I am serving as the administrator at English Rose. We're in Edina and Minnetonka, Minnesota, and we provide memory care and assisted living in the metro area. And we provide residential care, meaning that we have homes that house people with dementia. And then again, we have assisted living and home care as well. So we have quite the care community over there in the metro.
Okay. Can you just explain for people the difference between memory care and assisted living? Because not everybody understands that.
Yeah, absolutely. So memory care would be categorized as anyone living with dementia, generally. So any kind of memory loss, it can range from mild cognitive impairment to Alzheimer's. We see Lewy body dementia, vascular dementia, frontotemporal dementia. And then assisted living is folks who just need care. It can be a wide range. We in our assisted living setting will care for skilled medical in addition to those who even might be more independent. So the only differentiation for us is the memory care need there.
Are your homes separated, your communities, or are they mixed?
Do you mean geographically?
No, I'm talking in terms of memory care and assisted living.
Yes. So we have memory care specific homes, and then we have one assisted living home that we hope is going to grow into having several other homes that can do assisted living. We like to think of it as a continuum of care. Anyone who needs any level of care, be it memory care or just general day-to-day companion care, you know, we can be there to help along the way.
Wonderful. Well, thank you. Well, let's go to my next question that I always ask everybody, and that is, have you been personally touched by dementia in your own family or circle of friends?
Certainly. So my grandfather lived with my family a couple of years after receiving an Alzheimer's diagnosis. He moved in when I was 12 years old. And I want to say I was maybe 14 when I became his primary caregiver and day-to-day companion. And I was homeschooled. I grew up homeschooled near Rochester, Minnesota, and that certainly played into why I was able to be such a critical part of his care. I would sit back in his room and work on my schoolwork and just was his constant companion for several years. He passed when I was 18, but those 4 years that I spent with him, it was morning cares, it was lunch together, it was doing things in the afternoon, and then I would be there to help him with bedtime cares as well. My mother was a registered nurse, so it was a calling of hers to care for my grandfather and not have him enter a nursing home. And so we were able to see that through to the end, all the way through hospice. And it definitely set the course for my career. And there's certainly a role that I feel I have to play as an advocate for people with dementia. From there, I worked in nursing homes. And then now I've returned more into this relationship-based care, where that's not to say that every nursing home doesn't provide that. But that's certainly the experiences that I had in nursing homes, working as a nursing assistant, a unit coordinator. I just didn't see that level of care that we were able to provide for my grandfather. And that's what kind of caused me to shift into this more residential kind of relationship-based care that we provide at English Rose. So yeah, definitely a vocational kind of calling for me that began very early in my life.
Wow. And you were homeschooled before homeschool was really well known.
Yes, before the pandemic, right?
Yeah. Now, you know, you had mentioned you worked in long-term care for a long time, you know, as a nursing assistant. And I would imagine you've seen a lot of different types of residential settings out there, which you referred to in terms of kind of, you know, morphing back to this more relationship-based type care. What kind of styles were you seeing out there, and what are the differences between them? I don't think our families know that.
Certainly. So the nursing homes, the settings that I would have worked in prior to English Rose, they were nursing homes, right? One was a very traditional kind of nursing home. This would have been the early 2010s. And, you know, curtain down the middle of a large bedroom, two hospital beds on either side, Jack and Jill style bathroom shared between four people, more of a very traditional care setting. And then I also got to be on kind of a higher end setting after that. And it was attached to a hospital system. It was very, again, high end. It was private bedrooms, private bathrooms, but the same ratio of caregiver to client or resident. We called them patients in those settings. We prefer residents in our setting. So when you ask the biggest difference between traditional nursing home kind of settings and residential settings, I think that would be the answer, is the ratio of caregiver to residents. I remember, you know, in both settings, I had anywhere from 14 to 16 people that I was charged with. And in a nursing home, neither setting was exclusively memory care. So it was skilled care and memory care in both of these settings. Most of our patients had dementia of some kind. But when you have 14 to 16 people, it's go, go, go. And so more important than the ratio, in my opinion, would be the relationships, right? So I've referred to relationship-based care a couple of times now. At English Rose, we have a 1-to-3 ratio. And I think that's pretty standard now in residential settings, where you have a residential home with 6 to maybe 10 residents, you know, they try to keep it that 1-to-3, 1-to-5 ratio, because we've learned as an industry that makes all the difference when working with dementia. And so if we were talking to families about, you know, what should you be looking for when looking for care for their loved ones, I think it is about ratio, but at the same time, I think relationships and capacity for relationships is even more important, right? Because as a caregiver in a setting where we had 14 to 16, I still prided myself in trying to really get to know those residents. And, you know, if you can find a setting that really empowers caregivers to take charge and to build relationships, and even to a word we don't use in the field of medicine is love. Those who love what they do or love the people that they care for, I think that's an integral part of care that we often don't consider because, again, in the medical field, that's a weird word. It's an uncomfortable word. But I do. I think ratio is important, but I think relationships and kind of the empowerment for the caregivers is crucial.
Oh, I agree. And I'm glad that you defined residential care because a lot of communities, which are much larger, refer to themselves as residential care, but you're talking really kind of a small group home type concept, really very home, like in a house
Yes, ma'am.
type setting. And a lot of people don't even know that that is an option. It's, and I love that you mentioned the love and kindness. You know, when you get to relationship, you're gonna create bonds because you're not just task oriented. You're not just running from one task to another task, and you apply getting that task done very differently, you know, depending on how it's viewed and the time crunch, all in all. Now, I would imagine you believe highly in English Rose's approach, you know, towards care, but there's also this whole aspect of medication management, I think, that rolls into that. And so can you talk a little bit about that, in especially the antipsychotics that have been used and were primarily used for many, many years in terms of controlling care and kind of subduing people so that they weren't so much work, and how that whole phenomenon sits now in the general market, but especially in English Rose.
Well, first, anytime I talk about medications, I like to just say I'm not a doctor, you know, by any means. I consider myself an advocate of our residents and of anyone living with dementia, a care partner. You know, anything philosophically as we approach, you know, our English Rose approach, it comes from experience. You know, we have between our leaders. You know, I've been here for 6 years. Our administrator's been, or our chief operations officer has been here for over 20 years. We have a lot of combined experience, and this has been in the DNA of English Rose since we began in '97. That kind of using antipsychotics in a traditional way, it can be different. It doesn't have to be done the way that it is done. And you kind of referred to some of that. You know, it's meant to manage. It's meant to make the care that we provide possible in those settings. Unfortunately, there's a really big difference between being responsible for 14 to 16 people at a time and being responsible for six. So we have the gift of time in our environments where I did not have that time in those settings. I've done the math before, and I would have 15 minutes at a time with each client to get them up and ready for bed in the morning. I like to think I'm a low maintenance kind of guy. It takes me about a half hour to 45 minutes to be up and out the door in the morning. And I like to think that I have a healthy brain up here. But we were expecting people with dementia, with a neurodegenerative disorder, to be up and to breakfast in 15 minutes. And that never sat well with me, and still doesn't. And so the English Rose approach really boils down to kind of this. I think it's becoming more mainstream of an idea, but it's the idea that behaviors, a word that we use a lot in this industry, behaviors are not a symptom of Alzheimer's or dementia. And I think a lot of people would be surprised to hear that. I think that there would be people who may contradict that based on experience, but we really consider behaviors. We don't really like to use the word at English Rose, but we consider behaviors to be communication. And we grant our residents a right to a full range of emotion. I think that you and I would agree. I think everyone listening would agree that people will always be people. And there are some really challenging, difficult people in the world, you know, and in our day-to-day lives. And in that context, we just choose not to maybe be around those people, or we choose not to be friends with those people, or, you know, whatever the case may be, where someone living with dementia, they don't really have that right. The caregiver that is going to care for them today, the place that they are, they don't get to just pick and choose kind of who they're having relationships, who they're interacting with. And you throw that on top of, again, a neurodegenerative brain disorder, it can get ugly at times. There is resistance to care. There are times when someone may act out or misbehave. You know, this kind of binary expectation of someone always behaving or misbehaving, we feel like it's unrealistic to just who people are. So the English Rose approach really boils down to, let's not just look at this as a symptom of dementia. Let's look at how we can prevent it in a holistic way as much as possible. We don't believe that antipsychotics are bad inherently, but we do believe that we should be using them to get someone comfortable proactively if they're having symptoms of psychosis, if they're having delusions that bring about anxiety and agitation. Those are not things that we want our residents to be experiencing. However, if we have a resident or a client who is receiving constant PRNs, Seroquel, Zyprexa, whatever, you know, something's off. Something's wrong with our approach. We're not just going to say this person has dementia and that's why they're having these behaviors. We want to look at things analytically. We want to bring our caregivers to the table. It's really about looking at it analytically and trying to find those factors, the context within which someone may be responding the way that they're responding. Again, as our industry, I feel like we're much more prone to just think, okay, this is dementia, these problems that are happening. And it starts at the top where, you know, I've worked with nurses and providers who that's really how they view it. And then I've worked with caregivers who, you know, I know that this person is going to spit at me because they spit at me every single morning. And so they enter the room ready to be spit at, which is not fun by any means. I tell the story in our dementia training of a caregiver I worked with who would go into a woman's room with a pillow and her arm and the pillowcase over, you know, over her arm. And she would use the pillow like a shield because she anticipated that she was going to get spit at. And I imagine, you know, being that individual and laying in bed, and that's who comes in, you know, in the morning to get me up for the day. I think I might have behaviors, you know, if that was my every morning experience as well. I think I'm rambling now, but hopefully that kind of answers your question as to kind of how we view those antipsychotics differently.
Well, and I think it's so important. I've always said it, you know, I don't like the word behavior either, because that's not a compliment. And when we use it repeatedly for somebody day after day after day, they're going to start thinking, you know, they're just this mean, nasty person, because that's how everyone sees them. And they really are just clues and reactions that we have to interpret when a lot of their skills have gone, you know. And then I think, too, you know, I have my bad days when I don't act as nice as I should. And we expect someone with dementia for that to never happen. You know, that we all have these emotions that we go through. We have our good moments, our bad moments, but that doesn't need to be pegged or attached, like you said, to the disease. That's kind of the easy way out, is just to blame on dementia. And a lot of times I think what's difficult, and I know you guys do a good job with this, is looking inward of, am I triggering that reaction? Am I doing something? How are they perceiving me, and why? Is it my tone of voice, or maybe they don't like my cologne, or maybe I now remind them of someone they just didn't like, or get along with. I mean, there could be so many factors and sensory factors, like too hot, too cold, too whatever it might be, or you're the person who's going to give me a shower and you're not gentle with me. You're not kind with me. You know, you're rushing me. Like you said, 15 minutes, we expect them to be ready and down for dinner, but we don't get ready that fast on a typical day. You know, so all of that stuff comes into play. And I think our tone of voice and our mannerisms are really important to take in. You had mentioned, you know, you're not against the antipsychotic medications, but it has to really be for a management purpose of hallucinations or delusions or something specific versus, you know, someone just trying to communicate with you. How do you teach that to staff? Do you find staff come in going, well, just give them a pill. Can't you give them something for that? You know, or do they learn that right away from onboarding and training?
You brought up something that I want to circle back to, because it actually answers this question as well, which is that we don't talk in, you know, at least in my experience, we didn't talk much about ownership as caregivers. When I went through a CNA course, and I've spoken to caregivers about this, and to my knowledge, again, it's not something that's in the day-to-day curriculum. You know, how are you contributing to a specific interaction or a negative experience? And that is, I think, probably the most important thing for a care partner to know, is that this person that you're caring for, who may have dementia, they're not in the driver's seat if that's the case. Everything is reactionary. If they could, you know, see themselves treating you this way, they would be mortified. And that's true of a lot of people. You know, I mentioned those difficult people who maybe they wouldn't, you know, but a lot of people, I think, would truly be mortified to see themselves spitting at someone or swinging at someone who's trying to get them up for the day. And so if they're not in the driver's seat in that context, then we as care partners have to take ownership for the entire situation, right? Whereas if we're two people, if you and I don't get along, we both need to take a little bit of ownership of how we are treating one another. This person is going to likely be incapable of doing that. I remember as a very young CNA saying to a woman who was pinching me, I said, "That hurts." And she gave me, she used some expletives, but her message was, "It's supposed to hurt." You know, and I remember thinking, oh, she really just does not care. You know, she's really defending herself. It is fight or flight. It's this kind of primal response to this thing. And I think caregivers, and I think caregiver burnout is we could do a whole episode on caregiver burnout, but I think that our reaction as care partners is, you know, I don't want to deal with this. I don't deserve this. I'm trying to help you and you're trying to stop me from, you know, being successful in helping you through your morning routine. So I think ownership is a huge thing that we teach. I think that it takes a little while for the average caregiver to come in and kind of see that and to kind of get on board with that, because it is, we do, a new caregiver has worked in a traditional care setting. They call the nurse line, you know, Lori's having behaviors. We need a PRN right now. And there's a lot of education, and it has to be iterative, and it has to be shoulder to shoulder as to what have we tried, what is the context, and how can we improve the outcome without having to use an antipsychotic. So there's constant coaching that's happening. And again, it has to be shoulder to shoulder with our nurses to help them see that, oh, we can de-escalate this. I do, just to kind of give an example of kind of what I'm talking about, I do wanted to share a brief story about a caregiver that we have who works in several of our environments. She is one of the best, if not the best, caregivers I've ever worked with. And I observed her walking by a residence room. Again, imagine a residential bedroom in this little cottage that we have that's off of Blake Road in Edina. And she walks by and she sees a resident tapping her feet, like literally just tap, 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 tap. She's wringing her hands. And this caregiver knows this person. And she knows that That's anxiety. That's what anxiety looks like for this resident. She's kind of rocking back and forth. And so this caregiver takes it upon herself to enter the bedroom. And she says to this resident, I'll change her name just for HIPAA reasons. She says to this resident, Alice, we just got a new dishwasher. Just this is off the cuff. We did not get a new dishwasher, but we just got a new dishwasher. I have no idea how to load it. Do you want to take a look at it and help me load this dishwasher? And this woman, who was a 90-something grandmother, you know, sees a young person who wants help, and she responds, I can hear her in my head, of course, you know, she's so happy to help, and goes into the kitchen and helps load the dishwasher. And she's teaching, she is doing something that has purpose, that has meaning behind it. And this caregiver, her name is Izzy, stands there and is just, you know, oh gosh, this is such a help, you know, thank you so much. And just gives her that level of just human interaction, right? Adversely, if she were to have sat there and continued to wring her hands, continued to kind of pat her feet on the floor, that anxiety is eventually going to boil over and that delusion is going to take hold. There's going to be paranoia. Why am I here? Where is my husband? Where are my parents? You know, that was the kind of thing that we would see with this person if there was no interaction. So in that scenario, in a more traditional care setting, we're going to use antipsychs, right? We're going to say, let's get this person a PRN. We've got to get them, we call it comfortable. We got to get them comfortable, right? It's just unnecessary when you have that level of oversight and you have that level of approach from those caregivers. And it, again, it comes from ownership. When it happens, when someone blows up and let's say Izzy didn't approach this person, it's being able to look at that and be like, huh, I did notice these things. There was anxiety happening. I'm going to be better next time. I'm going to improve my approach. I'm going to improve the way that I'm analyzing my residents on an hour to hour, 15-minute to 15-minute basis. You asked the question, though, about what is the appropriate attitude, you know, to have toward antipsychs. And I think it does boil down to, let's get this person comfortable, but then let's also look at the opportunity of tapering back over time. I think that that's something that we don't do enough of in a lot of traditional memory care settings, where we put this person on Seroquel, and they're on Seroquel until they go on hospice. You know, that was the experience with my grandfather, where my mother, a very new age nurse for the time, decided, you know what happens if we don't give him Seroquel? I know my mother's going to listen to this, and I just have to share that I'm trying to make her sound better. She forgot, if I remember correctly, to reorder his medications. And so there was a period of time when he didn't have Seroquel. So sorry, Mom. But my grandpa came out of his shell, is what we thought it was. It was him, you know, like, wow, he seems more clear. He seems more active. He's not sleeping as much during the day. And it was because he had gotten comfortable in that environment, and he was surrounded by the people who cared for him and loved him. And he no longer needed that energy to be kind of tamped down so that we could approach him without him being aggressive or anxious. There has to be oversight of that. There has to be ownership of that. Because most providers, they're looking at behavior documentation. And in my experience, it usually says something like, Lori had behaviors. You know, they look at that and there's no context. There's maybe time of day, you know, we can look at that sort of thing. But without identified context, we're making these decisions, we're prescribing these meds. And then ultimately, that might not get looked at again, unless a care provider really, you know, believes what we're talking about, which is that they might not be necessary over a period of time. So let's peel back. Let's try to get this person stable without the need. Because we know, you know, there are side effects for these drugs, and mostly they are sedative in nature. And if we can get a little bit more of that warmth and a little bit more of that just, you know, affect from that person further into their disease process, that can mean the world for their well-being and for their family as well. So hopefully that answers the question. I'm kind of going all around about here.
No, it's great. I think it's really interesting when you talked about, you know, your grandpa coming back out. I think that that does happen. And I think a lot of times people are so worried about not getting flagged, not documenting correctly, that they're not really looking at that big picture of usage. It's like documented correctly. That's what we're really covering our butts for, because that's what we're going to get nailed on, you know, when the state comes through.
Exactly.
And to be able to kind of see that reawakening is beautiful. I also like, you know, when you talk about taking ownership, one of the things I do when I do training is I talk about care styles, and everybody's caring style is different. You know, some people might be
certainly
really passionate. Some people might be boom, 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 you know, really strict. Some people might like certain tasks better. And I think acknowledging that is very important. And then also learning kind of that, that holistic style of care, you know, making people aware that there are styles of care and that people do approach it differently. And what can we learn from one another, and what style works best in which situation? I loved the story where, you know, you talked about the resident or approaching the resident in terms of helping, you know, giving her purpose to be able to teach and be who she's always been. And your staff did that by tapping into their multi-sensory communication. It wasn't work.
Yeah.
And I think so often we overlook that multi-sensory communication. Day to day, we take it in and we don't even know that we're making judgments and we're coming up with assumptions based on somebody's facial expressions or whatever they're doing. We just their words until the words aren't enough. And I hear that from people with dementia all the time, you know, like they get upset with us when we talk to them and our head is turned or our back is to them. And they're like, no, I need to see all of this to really know what you're saying to me. And that stuff is so, so critically important.
Well, and what, if I could, Lori, one thing that I do want to also mention is that it is, I think that as we have these kinds of discussions, we make it really complex. You know, let's really, you know, this person is an Alzheimer's whisperer. I don't know if you've heard that kind of verbiage, but it's used in nursing homes for that person who just gets it, right? Wow, they can get anybody up. And if you really look at that person, they're not doing anything astronomical, right? They're not doing anything. We call it a holistic approach, but we're not talking about, you know, charms and essential oils. I mean, essential oils are great and important, but we're talking about just giving someone the opportunities to still communicate like a human being, right? For me, it was always looking at or asking the question, why did it happen? You know, if I were slapped by a person and, I was trying to get them up for the day and I was rushing them just through the nature of how much time I had to spend with them, right? The answer is they don't want to get up. It's that simple. You know, we act like it's this really complex thing. Okay, I'm trying to get this person up at 6 a.m. Maybe they were a later riser, you know, traditionally, historically, their circadian rhythm is used to getting up at 7:30 or 8 o'clock, and we're trying to peel them out of bed at 6. The answer is simple. They don't want to get up. So if we know that about that person, don't force them to get up, reapproach them, decide what time we as a team are going to get this person up. Maybe it's, you know, familiarizing them with the time of day going into that room. Lori, it's about 7:30 a.m. I know you like to get up at 8. I just wanted to let you know that you're next on my list. And I'm going to play this music that I know you like, and I'm going to use essential oils maybe, or whatever it is that we can establish Lori needs to be successful in getting up. Or again, adversely, it's entering that room knowing that there are going to be behaviors, or knowing that I need to duck and bob and weave, depending on the person. So I think asking why when those things happen is so important. And the answer can be because they have Alzheimer's, but that's not the only answer for any scenario, right? We have to look at the other factors that are present.
Well, and I think that's a key point. There's the approach of being right, and this is on schedule, and this is what I have to do right now, and being successful. Mm-hmm. And how would we want to be, and how would we want to be approached? We want to have a successful life. We want to feel comfortable. We want to fit in. So how can staff help somebody get there? And that just makes sense. And of course, there would be less behaviors or reactions when you feel comfortable. I do want to just take a quick break here. And for those of you that might just be tuning in right now, we've been talking with Zach Parlier with English Rose, and we're talking about doing dementia differently. How do you care in a really substantive, profound fashion that makes a difference, not only in the person with dementia's life, but in yourselves as care partners and those around that see that. You can always go to their website for more information, which is EnglishRoseSuites.com, or you can call them at 952-983-0412 or email them at hello@EnglishRoseSuites.com. They're also on Instagram. Next, we're just going to hear about QBlox, which is a fantastic webmaster, and then we'll be right back with Zach. I also want to introduce you all to QBlox. They have been absolutely excellent to deal with. They have been in business for 18 years, and they serve the globe. I can't say enough good things about this company. I've had a lot of bad experiences, I don't know about you, with tech companies. They have made a very complicated process very easy, and their staff is so kind, so polite, so respectful to work with. And you know, when I am frustrated and ready to pull my hair out, they just smile and tell me everything's going to be okay. And they really are just on top of the communication, which alleviates so much stress as an owner when you're dealing with tech issues. You can get a 10% discount. Visit them at QBlox, that's QBlox.com, or you can email them at letstalk@qblox.com. For that 10% discount, just put Lori, L-O-R-I, in the inquiry form. And again, I don't think you'll be disappointed. I surely haven't been. I can't rave enough about this company, and that's kind of rare these days. So, Zach, let's talk about meaningful engagement and play as an intervention towards dealing with these unwanted reactions people are having or behaviors. Mm. I have a hard time even saying that word behavior once I to phrase them as cues and reactions. It just kind of turns my stomach, but I know that's what most people call it. And so we have to use that term on an educational standpoint. So how do you flip the switch and use play and engagement to help out in those situations?
I think it's an important question because, you know, when we look at, you know, I'm not joking when I say this, we refer to behaviors at English Rose as the B word behind closed doors. You know, that's how we really try not to use it. So we prefer the word expression or expressive communication, or we just talk about what actually happened, you know. But a really, really important role, in preventing these things is meaningful engagement. And one thing that, we have pursued with the way that we approach our activities, another word we don't love to use in our settings, is to look at normalcy and to look at what people would be doing at home versus being in a residential, you know, living community. I think that, you know, I don't think maybe studies have been done that I'm not aware of, but I do believe that if we did a mass study on satisfaction of people living in nursing homes, if the, you know, very binary question of would you prefer to live at home or would you prefer to live in a nursing home? I have a hunch, you know, overwhelmingly the answer would be I would much rather be at home, right? And so if that's the case, how can we emulate home? Not the physical environment. How can we emulate that feeling of home? And it's interesting. I'll just share kind of what brought us to this conclusion that this is the direction we wanted to go with meaningful engagement is we made a change to our menu. And so how does that relate to meaningful engagement? We realized we were having a lot of leftovers after our afternoon meal, after lunch. And it was because our meal planning, you know, we would have big meals for lunch. We would have enchiladas. We would have meatloaf and mashed potatoes for lunch. And so we kind of had this epiphany of who's eating enchiladas and mashed potatoes at home, right? Who's actually doing that? There are people, I'm sure, that do, but most older adults are having a sandwich, having a salad, having some soup, having something light, and then having their larger meal, you know, at 4:30 or 5 in the afternoon, maybe 6, whatever. So we changed our menu. We literally, we kind of started talking to our residents. We started an assisted living. They loved the idea. These are individuals that are going to be able to tell us, yes, we don't want enchiladas. We'd prefer soup and salad. That sounds great. And so it was a hit. We did it in memory care, and we continue to do that now. What does it have to do with engagement? We looked at our activity calendar and we realized it's not really looking very different from nursing homes, from assisted livings, from long-term care. We want it to be unique. We want it to be unique to the English Rose experience. And so we took that idea of what are people doing at home and how can we emulate that? So we're no longer doing, we'll still include for someone who enjoys arts and crafts or enjoys bingo, but most people aren't sitting at home playing bingo 7 days a week at 2 in the afternoon, right? So we took our activity calendar and we called it our meaningful engagement menu. If you can think of it, if anybody out there can think of a better word, this, we're in beta phase. I can't stand the word menu. So reach out to me. But we built this schedule around the way that we define well-being at English Rose. So if you consider behaviors, expression to be ill-being, well, then we want our residents to experience well-being, right? Not that let's experience, let's pursue well-being in everything we do. So we built our activity menu off of cognitive engagement, purposeful engagement, spiritual engagement, social engagement, and physical well-being. And our days at English Rose are filled with those five things. And it can be anything within that category. We might do exercise in the morning, but we're going to do something cognitive before lunch. It might be in memory care. We love this website called The Good News. They're fantastic. They just put out good news. There is good news out there, believe it or not. And we review that with our residents and they love it. We're still doing things like trivia. We're doing things in the afternoon that might have to do with baking. We're trying to really do the things that we would be doing at home in our residences. So what does all of that have to do with prevention of expression? I really believe, and I teach this in our dementia training, and there is some comedic value to this, but I really believe that people are meant to do people stuff. And when you move someone into long-term care, they don't really feel like they're doing people stuff anymore. And I believe that if you sit with a battery that's full all day long and you're not socializing, you're not around other people, you're not experiencing this kind of complex model of well-being that we talk about, then you're going to bubble over. There's too much energy in there. And we call it sundowning in our industry, where someone who sits all day, someone who has a lot of energy, their circadian rhythm later in the day is going to be thinking something needs to be happening. And that can just be a recipe for a lot of delusion, a lot of anxiety. I've got to go home. Where's my, you know, spouse? And we believe that if you can really, really experience that well-being that is something different happening several times throughout the day, we're around other people, we all have the same goals and interests, that you're not going to see that level of nervous energy later in the day. Our residents sleep through the night, and that's something we're very proud of because we keep them busy through the day. There's a second part of how we look at meaningful engagement that is more individualized. So those five elements of well-being that I named, each person has something in their bucket that is going to bring them joy or well-being in that category. If you're not religious, well, spiritual well-being is more than just about going to church or doing devotions. Spiritual well-being is about being outside. It's about listening to music or meditating and really fueling that part of, you know, that unique part that makes us human. And we find that in each individual so that they can experience that in whatever way. So if Lori really enjoys puzzles and she really enjoys following current events, that's going to fall into her cognitive bucket. And if she's not interested in our art group that's happening, then I should, as a caregiver, be looking at Lori, who's by herself, not participating in an activity, and looking at your individual blueprint of engagement and going and doing a puzzle with you. That's the kind of culture that we want in the subject of meaningful engagement. So we think it's unique. We're really proud of it. And we're only building off of this idea of people want to do people stuff. They don't want to play bingo all day, every day.
That's very true. When you were talking about that meaningful memory menus, I thought maybe just call it meaningful memory lifestyle, because it really gets back to the core of the person and what was their lifestyle. What did they enjoy? Because we are all individuals. And because I was looking at options and choices and all of that, but it really does get down to those lifestyle choices and what brings you joy. And I had to giggle too when you were talking about the menu and the meatloaf and the enchiladas, and then we wonder why they're sleeping during the day and up during the night, and you know, and it's like, because we put them there, you know, we did that ourselves.
Yeah.
So often we're not taking responsibility for those things. So it's nice that you guys have this approach of really digging deeper and learning from, you know, what isn't working. And instead of looking at it as a failure or saying, this is the way we've always done it, so this is the way we're always going to do it, you're saying, how can we make this better? And let's brainstorm that. Why do you think it's taken so long for, you know, the meaningful engagement piece to really take hold in healthcare? It still drives me absolutely crazy that we do not have social prescribing. Everything is a pill that is, you know, subscribed to, instead of all of these things that we can tap into even before somebody has to, you know, maybe make a move or go to adult day or any of those types of things, that they can really tap into as individuals. There's no good way to find even what exists for to even know what to ask for these days, it seems like.
It's a really important question. And I've thought about it a lot. You know, why is this not just, you know, standard operating procedures that we keep people busy with things that bring them joy, and they're not going to have these negative expressions if done well, right? I really believe that we, as the field of medicine, want to fix everything. We want to fix, 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 fix. And so when we look at it in that light, you know, you look at something like dementia, you can't fix it. There is no fix. There is, you know, no cure for Alzheimer's disease at this time. And so when you look at it with the goal of fixing it and with us not making any progress in that light, I think we have no choice but to look at our other kind of disciplines within medicine that we can use to try to treat symptoms. And I think that that's why pills are prescribed. That's why we're not looking beyond that. You know, I've read the book several times now, Being Mortal. You know, I think a lot of people have, it's a very popular book in our industry. And Dr. Atul Gawande talks about how, you know, medicine is about fixing, where if you have something like a terminal illness or you have something like a dementia, there is no fix. And so we need to pursue the moment versus pursuing, you know, prognosis. How do we improve prognosis? Well, let's take it moment to moment and make every moment the best that it possibly can be. And that's done through, like you said, social prescribing or looking at someone's, you know, day-to-day engagement. How can we, if they're isolated, you know, how can we help that person come out of their shell a little bit? How can we help get them involved socially? But yeah, I really believe that we as an industry, hopefully, are shifting. I believe that we are shifting in that direction of, okay, we've tried it this way for a very long time. You know, it still boggles my mind that I think it was 2 years ago, it became mandatory to have to talk about person-centered care in memory care settings. Only 2 years ago, we started talking about how people are people. Let's treat them as such. Let's give them agency and rights even when they're living with something like dementia. So that idea has been around since the 90s, but it took that long for it to pick up steam. Hopefully we're turning the page, and we want to be at the forefront of that. We want to try to be rock stars in that way, teach other people about this and be leaders in the area of engagement, and try to continue to pursue, whatever is next, and how we better engage people in a meaningful way.
Yeah, it is shocking that that was just only 2 years ago, the whole person-centered care. But I think it's the wrong verbiage. I know a lot of people will disagree with me, but I hate that verbiage. I think it's overused. I think it's underdelivered, and it's not understood by the general public. I think relationship-based care summarizes it so much better, and it gets us out of that task mode and into relationships, which is what we all want. We all want to feel like we're part of a community. And to me, that is just such a critical piece. I struggle with the verbiage we use on a lot of levels. So often things are changed, but they're changed for the, in my opinion, the wrong reason. I look at the even the labels for diagnosis, how many people were told they had Alzheimer's, and then all of a sudden, oh no, you just have mild cognitive impairment. There's not mild about this, sweet pea. I lost my job. I can't work. I can't. This is mild. How did you even come up with that term? Walk in my shoes type thing. The switching gears from that caregiver to the care partner, which we're hearing much more people use the verbiage care partner, care companion, again, puts you back into relationship. I think our words are so important and not looked at. And then again, we get some that just want to keep changing the verbiage, which just makes it more confusing to the public too, instead of educating why this is what everyone calls it, but this is why we need to look at it differently, versus trying to make that stamp and the change, even with the neurodiverse and the neural this and it just the general public's just kind of getting their arms around Alzheimer's and what is dementia. And it's too much, I think, for people to take in sometimes.
Yeah, it's a lot, but I love what you said about relationships, because just if I could go back to, talking about love. And love, it is a weird word, right? It's an uncomfortable word, I think, for some people. Maybe a better word is trust, right? Where it's the phenomenon in dementia. I really believe that I don't know your name. I don't know how I know you, but I know that you're familiar to me, and I know that we've got good vibes. And I can't tell you how many times as a caregiver I have sat in the break room and been like, how does this work? It doesn't make sense. If you look at short-term memory, you look at long-term memory. I really believe that when you pursue relationship and you're able to achieve that trust, that next level is love. I've had so many residents that I've cared for over the past several years who I consider to be, my grandparents, on that same level of, I cry at their funeral. They became part of my experience. I became part of their experience, and it is that, hand-holding through what they're going through. And I think for so long, just to go back to what you asked about the field of medicine, we've looked at memory care, which that's another, if we're talking about verbiage we don't love, I don't love that verbiage. But if we're talking about a traditional memory care environment, we've always thought that memory care is holding their hand on their journey to the afterlife, right? It's almost looked at like an extension of hospice. And that comes from, it's terminal. There's no hope for that person. And we look at it so differently, where it's like, yeah, you've got dementia, but we're going to make the absolute best of it. And that can be done through, again, relationships leading to trust, which eventually become love. And there's a woman that we cared for years ago. I was a home manager. And I only built the relationship with her at first out of proximity, meaning that I was the person they would all blame on all of her grievances. She didn't want to be here. She's being held here against her will. She wanted me to be in touch with her lawyer. Her children were coordinating an effort against her to keep her away from, you know, she had all of these delusional thoughts, had vascular dementia on top of Alzheimer's, and was very, very, very angry with her circumstances. The only reason I built a relationship with this person, who I know would have been over-medicated in a nursing home, is because I sat there and listened to her. And again, I was the person she was upset with, but eventually I became the person who sat there and listened to her and, you know, would take notes and would give her a sense of my anxieties, my problems in the world right now matter to somebody. And we were able to build a relationship based on that foundation. And she would come down into my office and she would knit. She was often believing that she, you know, had wool that needed to be delivered to different places. She owned her own business with, I believe it was alpaca, that she would sell their wool. And so she was constantly in this delusion of, you know, there's wool that needs to be delivered. And it was me as her assistant in those scenarios telling her, I got it. I'm going to take care of it. If I don't have a relationship, if there is no trust, she's not going to believe me when I say that. But when you build these meaningful relationships with people, you can actually get them to let go of those things that they're hanging on to, because they're hanging on for dear life because of their cognitive capacity. And when they let go and you redirect them, another word I don't love, we could do an episode on words we don't like, you know, in our industry, but you pull them into something that brings them joy. That can all be done when they trust you and you're not just the 12th caregiver that they've seen in a 2 or 3 day span. I really, really believe that, like you said, relationship-based care is what it's all about. And it's not difficult. And it drives me nuts that we make it so difficult. Relationships, they're everything.
Yeah, I agree. And I loved how you talked about, you know, validating her, like with Tony File, who passed away just this last Christmas.
Yes.
You know, I mean, she fought so hard to get that concept of we have to validate people's feelings and step in their world and where they are. The other thing you had mentioned was just the kind of the confusion of how can they trust you? Where does all of that come from? I don't know if you've ever heard of the SPACLE program, but my friend Cindy Lazinski is the only person I think here with a kind of a master license for the program, which came from England from Peggy Gardner. But she explains it like a photo album, which I find fascinating. And she says, you know, we have these photos of our life that, you know, tell us all about our history and our experiences. And the photos will die and the context of time and day and who was there, but the feelings remain. And so you're giving, you know, these people a feeling of belonging, a feeling of they trust you, that you are their listening post and you do care. And just like when you're a person who might be really coarse, you're going to be a person that they don't trust. And they're going to react to that as well. And those things are just so critically, critically important. I love how you guys have really changed. I shouldn't say changed because English Rose has always been this, but English Rose as a whole has always approached things in a holistic, caring manner. It's always been deep in relationship. And I so agree that we can get rid of a lot of the agitation and the aggression by paying attention, doing things a little bit different. And I agree, it does not have to be that difficult, but fear-based and complicated has always been motives and for people to sell product or get donations. And that's kind of been at the crux of all this. If we make it really hard, then they need us. But if it's not, then they won't. Well, there's still a lot of tricks in between there, you know, that they're still going to need you to be able to serve and to be able to help. But, you know, giving, you know, when you are leading by example with the loved ones who are placed there, leading by example for family members to say, I can do this differently too.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's a huge, huge factor. And all of a sudden then they become your raving fans. They come around more because they feel more comfortable. I mean, remember seeing that in the nursing home with my mom. People just wouldn't come because there wasn't a place for them. They didn't feel like they fit into this setting, and they didn't know how to make that right, how to correct that. But then as they saw, you know, people like myself engage more, all of a sudden they were coming around more. They were seeing different things in a different light. They were volunteering. It felt like a safe place to come, where mm-hmm. a lot of times it doesn't feel like a safe place to visit, and people feel really awkward. And so I think it's brilliant, you know, in your design of the whole company, in what you do and how you do it. I think it's so important. And I would love to see that expanded in other locations, and also for people to be able to retain the staff. I mean, you know, people being with you for 20 years, we don't hear that in the industry. And that loss of staff is, you know, we're losing the story of the why we've changed and why we're doing things differently. And that can't be replaced. You've got that high level of turnover. You know, it gets lost in the shuffle, and there's not that true heart level understanding. And I think that's critically important as well. And I think that has harmed us in healthcare in general, in terms of people want to show up and be part or not with that.
Yeah. Well, and I feel like we've kept things very positive, and I don't want to, as we're wrapping up, end on a negative note. But, you know, I look at our industry and the fact that I really believe, you know, positive things are in the future, but we can't ignore the fact that, you know, places are still so understaffed because of what you talked about, the attrition rates are horrendous. You know, I looked at, when our license changed over, a lot of licensure changed again 2 years ago, right? And I was looking at the requirement for ratio in the state of Minnesota, and it had changed in such a way that there was a lot of positives behind what was being regulated now that I expected to see, you know, some significant, you know, positive changes in the way that we're staffing. However, because of this caregiver shortage, we're still held hostage by the fact that there aren't enough caregivers to go around. There especially aren't enough really good caregivers to go around. And so in Minnesota, we still have as long as there are two people on at a time, and you can convince us that those two people can meet the level of care that is needed by these residents, that's okay by us, right? And, you know, our ratio is always a 1-3. So we have two caregivers at all times in our homes. And we don't work short-staffed. Our leaders, our chief operations officers working overnights, you know, we're all jumping in. We're all caregivers. And that's just not the way it is in a lot of settings. And so I feel like everything that we've talked about is it's simple. I really do genuinely believe that it's simple and it needs to be taught. But it's very, very, very challenging when you don't have the staff to do it, when you don't have the opportunity for relationships, when you don't have those who are invested in it because they're working 80 hours a week, or they're working with different clients and residents every single day. We've got a long way to go, I believe, as an industry. And again, I want to be positive, but what you talked about when you said that about retention, you know, you're starting over with every new caregiver that you get. You're starting over in that trickle down effect. If it's coming from the top the way that it should, if it's coming from the management and they really believe in the mission, then it's going to take a while before you can get that caregiver to be providing that level of care, especially if they're new to it and you're having to start over every single time you bring somebody else on to help them see it can be done differently. Dementia can be done differently than we do it in a lot of these settings that they're coming from.
I totally, totally agree. And I think too, when it comes to staffing, one of the problems that I see, and what do I know? Because I haven't been in that mode, you know, working that job for many, many years. But I think we're missing the ballpark when we're not focusing on building community for staff. We focus on it for the residents, but we have to have that staff involvement. I mean, I think back to, you know, when I worked in developmental disabilities, and I would work someone else's shift. I would stay for, you know, a blizzard for 2 days at the place. I mean, and I didn't think twice about it. And we had fun. You know, it was just like, okay, we're getting into survival mode. And everybody was in survival mode. The staff that were there, the residents, everybody pulled together. And we mm-hmm. were a team. And it wasn't like, oh, I have to stay here. Or it wasn't that at all. For 99% of us, it was like, this is our job and we're proud to be able to do it. And we love the people that we work with and we want them to be cared for. And yet mm-hmm. we did that in even a very large facility, which was 100 people. And, you know, those got ripped to shred and everybody had to go into small group homes and mm-hmm. people didn't really look at what we did or how we did it. You know, we had to do it different. It had to be kind of like a college campus, you know, all in type thing, cared for well. And I sometimes don't think we define what quality of life really means and how that can be carried out in a lot of different situations. And you guys have mm-hmm. that, I think, hard and fast, you know, in your mission in terms of what that looks like and how you as an organization has to adapt to them. And so often it's no, the resident has to adapt to the organization.
I think the same could be said for staff, like you're talking about. I mean, when we talk about our mission statement boils down to one word, we use well-being a lot in our settings. And I previously have been able to, in our classroom, teaching dementia training, review our mission and our vision and our values as a company. And I get to see the look in their eyes when we say, we're not just talking about well-being for our residents and clients. This is meant for anyone who comes in our doors, right? For our family members, for our vendors, for loved ones, whoever, but our staff. We want to know what brings you well-being. We want to know what kind of culture you're looking for. And if you show up for us, we're going to show up for you because we know that if we show up for you, you're going to show up. Like it's all about relationships again. And I think that, you know, we complicate things as an industry in trying to figure out what is going to keep staff, what is going to motivate them. Is it bonuses? Is it higher pay? You know, what is going to keep people around? And the good ones, and we got a lot of good caregivers at English Rose, they stick around because of those relationships. They stick around because we want to know what well-being looks like for them because we're trying to figure out what well-being looks like for our residents. It has to be, you know, a complete circle in terms of relationships all around. I need to know everything I can about my caregivers, everything they're willing to share about their personal life, the help that they need. We have a position at English Rose called the Life Navigator, where if you have any need, be it transportation, living arrangements, you're trying to set goals for yourself, you want to pay for a wedding in a year, we have this position available just to talk and to give you resources and to help you through whatever life circumstances that you're going through. And that's something we're very proud of, is the way that we look at our staff and the same way that we look at our residents, because that's just what empathy looks like. What are you going through? How can we help you? How can we make what we do here better? We often say it takes a village, and you need to have that kind of community that is all looking out for one another. And it's not just trying to be the first person to clock out at the end of the day. You know, we forget, I like to say whenever I do training, every one of our caregivers gets to clock out at the end of the day. You know, you could be working a 16-hour shift and it can be crazy because you're working a double, but our residents never get to clock out. They're here. And let's not lose sight of that and remember that they are why we are here. But then again, just to talk about the staff again, I mean, in order for them to provide that level of care and empathy, we have to be able to provide that for them as well.
Well, I mean, we all know when a caregiver is stressed or uncomfortable or whatever, they're not going to be able to care as well, or they're tired, exhausted. And so their well-being, in order to provide good care, you have to have good care for yourself, and to have mm-hmm. that support around you is huge. Well, I just can't thank you enough, Zach, for spending time. This has just been a great conversation. Again, we have been talking with Zach Parlier, with English Rose Sweets. And boy, we've just talked about how to really care well and how to do it differently and how it does not need to be as complicated as everyone has told us to be. So please be a giver of hope and join us and like, click, and share this episode. I think there are so many great nuggets that people can walk away with. And again, you can contact English Rose. A lot of times people like to call you by phone, and instead of getting, you know, push this, push that, you'll get a live person. Call 952-983-0412. You can email them at hello@englishrosesweets.com. And of course, their website is englishrosesweets.com. They're also on Instagram. And have a conversation. Check them out. I don't think you'll be disappointed. I know I surely wasn't with our conversation we had today. Mm-hmm. And I can say, you know, I've witnessed their level of care, and it is really something quite beautiful, and that we don't always see when we go looking. And a lot of times people tour, but they don't even know what to look for. So if you're here in Minnesota, I would definitely check out English Rose.
Again, thank you so much to our audiences. I really hope that you share this. This is just a wonderful opportunity for people to learn through another medium. And again, I'd like to highlight, please feel free to go to alzheimerspeaks.com to our free educational resources. We have a ton of them there for you. We've been curating them since 2009. So please take advantage and spread the word of that. If you are looking for a children's book or even one for yourself or a support group, check out Betty the Bald Chicken Lessons in How to Care. It is a book that is good for all ages and not just dementia specific, but it really makes us think about how we want to be cared for, how we treat others, and what we can do to all live a better life. And last, I will just mention Dementia Map, our global resource directory. Please feel free to use it. It's free. We're not going to ask you for any contact information. And of course, if you have a service, product, or tool, please enter that into the site. We have free and both paid plans. So everyone is welcome from profit, nonprofit, government agencies, and even those of you that don't think that you're a resource. Have a blessed week, everyone. Bye now.
Hi, this is Suzanne Newman, host of the Answers for Elders podcast and radio show. We are the North Star that guides you through the complicated journey of senior care with trusted experts in money, law, living solutions, and more. So join us on this station, your favorite podcast channel, or just go to answersforelders.com. Meet the way showers who will help your journey go a lot easier.